David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times, in for Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. There has been an awful lot of real life lately, with this weekend's show straddling the final two debates. There's anxiety in the air, and I can say that with confidence, having checked out our latest Marketplace Anxiety Index. We'll delve deep into the nation's financial psyche with our own Andrea Seabrook. We'll also journey to Spain, the UK, and into the digital realm of virtual reality. What else? We'll hear your stories about money and Halloween, and actor-filmmaker Mark Duplass takes the Marketplace quiz. As always, you can share your thoughts with us at Marketplace.org, on Facebook, or via Twitter at MarketplaceWKND. It's time now for the long and short. That's where we look at the news using the language of finance. Long, as in betting on something, or short, as in betting against it. This week, we have Andrea Chang, assistant business editor of the Los Angeles Times, party on, and Marketplace's own Kimberly Adams. Hey, you two.
Hi.
Hi, David.
So, Andrea, let me start with you. What are you long on this week?
This week, I am long on retailers going into low-income neighborhoods. And this is after Whole Foods a few weeks ago opened a new store in Englewood, which is in the south side of Chicago. It's a notoriously dangerous and low-income neighborhood. But Whole Foods has decided to take a risk and open a full-fledged store there and see how it goes. I like this idea because, you know, we read a lot about these food deserts in poor neighborhoods. And you know, a lot of these residents complain that they just simply don't have that many places to shop and get healthy options. So they're buying stuff at corner stores where it's a lot of like soda and chips or fast food restaurants or, you know, like a discount supermarket chain. That's even if they have one. I mean, in general, there's really not a lot there.
Right. And obviously, when it comes to that, it's produce, it's meat, it's fish, it's the healthy options that are hard to get into the lower income neighborhoods. And yet, the whole idea that Whole Foods is going to be the pioneer, I mean, this is famously Whole Paycheck.
Exactly. When you hear Whole Foods, that's very high-end and fancy. And when the company announced a couple years ago that they wanted to go into the south side of Chicago, a lot of people were like, there's no way that's going to work. Interestingly, a lot of the community members were saying, you know, if Whole Foods comes in, they want the full-fledged Whole Foods. They don't want like the 365 version that we're seeing here in L.A., which is like their in-house brand.
Well, slightly down market, yeah. More like Trader Joe's.
Right, right. Exactly. And they said, no, you know, if you're going to come here, we don't want your like poor man's version of Whole Foods. We want the whole thing. That being said, Whole Foods does need to change a couple of things. And they did say that when it comes to staples like eggs, they will price them more according to what else is available in the market as opposed to, you know, the most expensive version of organic cage-free eggs.
So if they can sell price-conscious eggs there, why can't they sell price-conscious eggs in my neighborhood?
Maybe you might have to take that up with Whole Foods.
So what are you short on this week?
I'm short on brain games. These are those online apps that have become really popular in the last few years. They promise to train your mind to stave off against, you know, dementia. It helps you with your, like, processing speed, your memory, your cognitive abilities. Turns out, according to a review of 400 different studies about brain games, they don't really actually work.
No!
Yes, and all they're actually doing is you're becoming better at the game, but that's not really being extrapolated to anything beyond the game.
So next you're going to tell me that taking ginkgo biloba isn't going to help my memory.
And crystals. What about crystals?
Or that, yeah. I forget what we were talking about. Oh, yeah, that's right, long and short. So let's go over, let's go over to Kimberly Adams. Hi, Kimberly, what are you long on this week?
Well, this week I am going to go long on leaks. Long on leaks as in digital leaks, leaks of videos, leaks of emails, and all of these things that have made our past week in politics so very, very interesting. The tape of Donald Trump that appeared from a leak, even though NBC apparently had it for a very long time.
Oh, was there a tape? I hadn't heard.
Yeah, it was this little something that came out just before a presidential debate, yes. And at the same time, there was this new WikiLeaks dump of all of these emails from the Clinton campaign about how they're operating. And I think it's just worth, you know, we all have to be really, really careful about everything we type, because when everything is committed in a digital format, I mean, this stuff never goes away. And I think as we continue to move forward in this election and just in politics in general, we're going to see a lot more stuff like this.
One thing about the leaks is the sourcing of these. I mean, in the case of the Donald Trump tape, this was hot mic material from Access Hollywood, whereas with the WikiLeaks data dump, according to intelligence sources, this was from potentially Russian government hackers.
Yeah, and that, you know, brings it to a pretty serious level in terms of where this, how this information is being leaked. I mean, you've got, as you said, two different ways of getting it. In the case of the Trump video, someone at NBC or at Access Hollywood leaked the tape to the Washington Post so that they could run with it. And on the other side of it, you've got what the U.S. government is saying is effectively state-sponsored cyber espionage, I guess.
Yeah, and that's why I'm of two minds about this. On the one hand, the Trump tape, I don't know if fair game is the right word, but it was out there just waiting to be found. The other one, you're right, it's cyber espionage. It is a crime, and if the sources are to be believed, it is state-sponsored crime. That seems like a whole other thing.
Yes, but regardless, it's still going to be a lot more information that people would probably prefer to be kept secret that we're going to be exposed to in the coming days and weeks, I'm sure.
So what are you short on?
Well, related to a similar topic, I'm going short on NBC. They are just having a lousy, lousy time of it. I mean, apparently NBC has been sitting on this tape for a while and got scooped by a competing news organization. And then this comes after the whole debacle at the Olympics with Ryan Lochte. And now Billy Bush has been implicated in this tape that, you know, a few of us may have seen. And that's no good for NBC. And at the same time, as all of this is happening, you have NBC's sister company, Comcast, being slapped with a $2.3 million fine by the Federal Communications Commission for charging people for things they didn't ask for. It's not been a good week for this media conglomerate.
Marketplace's Kimberly Adams, Andrea Chang of the LA Times. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks.
Thank you.
When Britain withdraws from the European Union, whenever that may be, it's likely to be a turbulent process. The formal negotiations haven't even begun yet, but already the British government has become embroiled in an angry row with some of the country's business leaders over immigration. It's a critical issue. If Britain wants to retain full access to the European single market, it may have to continue allowing EU citizens the right to live and work in the UK. From London, Stephen Beard reports.
The government believes that many people supported Brexit because of immigration and the pressures it's putting on public services. Rosemary Maddox is a Brexit voter from East London. Her concern, the availability of public housing.
I only voted out because my children will need somewhere to live. They're not going to get no council places because all the Europeans are taking them.
Tapping into that kind of anxiety, the ruling Conservative Party promised a crackdown on immigration in no uncertain terms. Here's the Home Secretary, Amber Rudd, speaking to party faithful at last week's annual conference.
This government will not waver in its commitment to put the interests of the British people first. Reducing net migration back down to sustainable levels will not be easy, but I'm committed to delivering it on behalf of the British people.
It won't be easy. Britain's immigrant population is increasing by 250,000 a year. The government plans to reduce that to the tens of thousands, an 80 or 90% cut. That pledge is raising concerns among some of Britain's most dynamic companies.
So we're making funky bikes in London and we're selling them all over the world.
Brompton Bicycles makes folding bikes for commuters, around 50,000 of them a year. The boss, Will Butler Adams, says the company exports 80% of its output to 44 countries. But the government's immigration target could jeopardise that exporting success.
We have staff from China. We have staff from France. We have staff from the Netherlands. Those staff help us trade. If, as a result of Brexit, we stick up barriers and we don't allow these switched-on clever people to come into our country and help us trade, that will be bad.
He admits the free movement of people around the EU has not brought only switched on clever people into Britain, it's brought a lot of unskilled migrants too.
Maybe we haven't had that calibre. Maybe get rid of the bottom 40% of what we were getting from Europe, replace it with more diverse, more higher skilled people from the rest of the world.
Another business leader who opposes the government plan is himself the perfect advertisement for immigration.
Meet the boss. By day, he runs a successful beer company, brewing impossibly smooth beer.
The man behind Cobra Beer, Lord Karan Bilimoria, came to Britain from India as a student in the 1980s. He founded the multi-million pound brewery, which now supplies 98% of the UK's Indian restaurants, and he's been appointed to the House of Lords. He's hopping mad over what he calls the government's anti-immigrant rhetoric.
I mean, that is shocking beyond belief. Shocking beyond belief. This is awful. This is dangerous. It is actually economically illiterate.
He says decimating immigration from the EU or elsewhere would be dumb and self-defeating.
This country would not be where it is today, one of the five largest economies in the world, without the contribution of migration over the decades.
But supporters of the crackdown say the most recent influx has held down the wages of unskilled British workers. Minister Amber Rudd accuses employers here of importing cheap foreign labour rather than training Brits. A question for Lord Bilimoria.
Doesn't she have a point that as somebody who controls immigration, she should put Britain first?
It's not a question of putting Britain first. We have one of the lowest rates of unemployment in our history, 5%. That's in spite of well over 3 million people from the European Union working here in the UK. What would we do without them?
After an outcry from business, the government has softened its rhetoric on immigration. Last weekend, it rode back on a plan to name and shame companies that employ a preponderance of foreign workers. But it insists it will cut migrant numbers substantially, because that's what a majority of Brits have voted for. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
A year ago, we released our first ever national economic survey. It's called the Marketplace Economic Anxiety Index, conducted in partnership with Edison Research. It's a way for us to gauge how people are actually feeling about the economy this election year. Well, the fourth wave of our poll is now out, and the findings aren't great. Americans' fear about their economic stability has steadily increased over the last year. Yet at the same time, most of those who responded to our poll said they're in a better financial situation personally. Marketplace's DC Bureau Chief Andrea Seabrook is here now to talk about the latest findings. Hiya, Andrea.
Hi there, David.
All right, so I'm trying to make sense of the up and down of this thing. First of all, the Marketplace Economic Anxiety Index, it's gone up, but people say they're better off.
Yes, isn't that strange? You know, our poll partners, Edison Research, we looked into this with them and said, you know, how can it be possible that people would get more and more fearful over this particular year? And it's not just this time we've done the poll. We've done it four times now. In the first wave, by the second wave, it went up 1 point. By the third wave, another couple points. Now it's up a full 6 points from the beginning of our poll. We think this has a lot to do with the, surprise, surprise, presidential election. When Americans are hearing media constantly tell them that things aren't good enough, that they could be better or should be better, or that they're being lied to or their jobs are going, even though things might be getting better for them personally, it increases our anxiety.
But those are all completely subjective data points. And yet you look at the objective data points, such as wages, they're up. Consumer confidence, up. Unemployment, down. And yet that doesn't seem to be resonating with people.
Totally. And it's very interesting. We added a section this time to the Marketplace Edison Research Economic Poll, where we asked people specifically, do you trust government data about the economy, which is really a key, important factor? And the truth is that a quarter of all Americans distrust the economic data that is reported by the federal government, including statistics like the unemployment rate, the number of jobs that are added, the amount of consumer spending. There's a big difference, though, here, David, between Trump supporters and Clinton supporters. It's pretty striking. Almost half of Trump supporters completely distrust the economic data from the federal government, and only 5% of Hillary Clinton supporters distrust it. And so there's a big disparity there.
Here's another one that I'm looking at, and this one says that most Americans think that the economy is rigged. What does that mean?
Well, you know, this is really fascinating because it's rigged is kind of a funky political economic word these days. Donald Trump has been using it. A lot of people have been using it to say that, you know, it's not a fair playing field, not a flat level playing field, as they say, you know. But, you know, when we asked people, most Americans believe the economic system is rigged in some way or another. We dug down a little bit on this number and asked people, okay, if it's rigged, then to whom? Toward whom? Who benefits from that so-called rigging? Fascinating that Americans, no matter who they were going to vote for, generally agreed that the system is rigged towards the rich. They were the ones that most people cited. Secondarily, politicians and corporations, most Americans believe, get a lot out of the system that other people don't have. One really important difference, though, is that among Clinton supporters, 62% thought that the economy is rigged towards white people. Only 21% of Trump supporters say that. And more than half of Trump supporters believe that the economy is rigged to benefit minorities, compared to only 19% of Clinton supporters. So that's sort of two sides of the same coin.
The thing that really jumps out at me is this element that the data and the statistics are untrustworthy. And it really speaks to what we've been hearing in this political season, that we've entered a post-fact era in which, you know, everyone makes up their own reality. And if that's the case, if we can't even agree on the veracity of the statistics, how can we ever come up with solutions to our problems?
It's a good question. And I think this has been a trend for years now, not just in our poll, but in many other indicators, that the trust in the government, the belief that our politicians are working for us, the approval ratings of Congress, I mean, my God, they've been down in the single digits. You know, it's just gone down and down and down. And we see that in the partisanship section of the Marketplace poll. More than half of Americans now are dissatisfied still by the current candidates for president. That's up from the first and third waves of our poll. It's just gotten worse and worse. And when we ask people to describe what they think about the 2016 presidential election, we gave them a bunch of adjectives. And the three that came up more than anything else, afraid, angry, and embarrassed. Three really negative feelings about this election.
Is there any sunlight anywhere on the horizon?
Well, a little over half of Americans also use the word hopeful. So there's a little bit of sunlight. I mean, Americans, I think we're those kind of resilient, you know, American dream kind of people. And we tend to think, well, this is just awful, but maybe something better will come along next.
And I'm going to cling to that. Marketplace's D.C. Bureau Chief Andrea Seabrook, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Are you stressed about your finances? Take our economic anxiety quiz at marketplace.org. National Retail Federation estimates that Halloween spending this year will hit a record and kind of scary $8.4 billion, including about $3 billion just for costumes. So this week we asked how much you're spending on Halloween. Do you go all out on your costume or decorations? Do you splurge on candy? If you're like listener Dave Barrett, the answer to both questions is yes. Dave is 43 and lives in Hamden, Maine. He came to us via Facebook. His family sees Halloween as a time to really do it up.
When I was a kid, I remember there was always the one house that was on the neighborhood that gave out the full-size candy bars, and they were the best house ever. And I promised myself that when I became an adult, I would be that house on the neighborhood that gave out the full-size candy bars. And it started out okay, and then we moved to Hamden, and the town doesn't have a whole lot of neighborhoods, And so a lot of the people who live here actually come to our neighborhood. They drive in, they park, and take their kids around. And so we've got about 60 houses or so in our little area. And I think last year we had about 600 kids come through. So it's a pretty busy time.
How many full-size candy bars does a man have to buy to anticipate such a crowd?
Well, about 600. This year, you know, last year was kind of a fluke. Last year was a Saturday, I think. And this year, Halloween's on a Monday. So we're estimating probably between 400 and 500 or so. I don't want to end up with 100 or 200 extra. So we're aiming a little bit on the lower end this year.
What's your budget?
The budget is honestly however much it takes to get the job done. You know, we go to Sam's Club to buy them in bulk. And so, you know, the candy will end up running us, well, $250, give or take, a little bit more in years past.
And how much have you spent on the decorations for your house?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I try not to ask. My wife said, oh, yeah, this year wasn't so bad. I only spent about $150 this year. Last year, evidently, because we had a haunted house in our garage, it was closer to $400 or so. But we're reusing a whole bunch of that stuff this year. So it's a pretty big deal at our house.
Dave, when you go all in, you go all in.
Yes, for Halloween, we certainly do.
Dave Barrett, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Have a great one.
Phil Lepanto is 44, from D.C., and also came to us through Facebook. In his old neighborhood, celebrating Halloween was a pretty big deal.
We were ground central for Halloween. Our whole street would close down, and we'd invite kids from all over the neighborhood to join a Halloween parade. Everybody participated. It was what we call the national holiday of our neighborhood.
So are you still in that neighborhood, or have you pulled up stakes?
We moved about 7 blocks north, and it's a much more sort of suburban feel to our neighborhood. So we got bored trying to hand out candy to the kids in our new neighborhood and went back to our old neighborhood and joined our old neighbors on the porch, and we brought some candy, and they let us contribute.
Well, wait a minute. You got bored? Does that mean you weren't getting a lot of trick-or-treaters?
No, there was hardly any kids there at all. In fact, our neighbors put out a dish of candy and took off to go to some party. We couldn't believe it. You know, our experience has been you have to be there and you have to be handing out handfuls of candy to keep up with demand. I used to tell the people that we'd invite over to help us hand out candy that, you know, my goal was to be the best house on the street. And you got to work it. You got to work at it.
So now when you go and hang in your old neighborhood, nostalgic? How do you feel?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely miss that from our old neighborhood. And I think it'd be if we felt like we had something more to decorate for, we might enjoy staying where we are.
Knowing what you know now, would you still have made the move?
Well, no. We don't like this neighborhood as much. It's only 7 blocks away. It's only a 20-minute walk, but it is a world of difference.
Seems to me that if someone's totally into Halloween, the thing you do before you buy new property is you go out to the new place on Halloween and see what it looks like.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you've seen the D.C. housing market, but you can't wait to that one night in the year to make a move on a house that you like.
Scary. Phil Lepanto, thank you so much for joining us.
See ya. Bye.
For listener Sharon Hanink, Halloween used to be a time to go all out. But after moving to an older, quieter community, things are different.
The first year I lived here, Halloween came along. I decorated. I noticed I was the only one on my side of the street who decorated. My neighbor said, you shouldn't even bother because they don't trick-or-treat here. They all go over to the wealthier neighborhoods. Kids, some even in this neighborhood, people commute from other neighborhoods. They all go over to the wealthier neighborhoods, to the McMansions, and they trick-or-treat exclusively, and they don't stop at anything on this side of the street.
Are you telling me that they won't even cross the street to get a Snickers bar?
Not at all. And it was very disappointing to me.
Sharon, you seem to be describing a key problem with the U.S. right now, and that's the wealth gap, the idea that there are haves and have-nots out there. You're describing the Halloween gap, where trick-or-treaters will go to the fancy houses and won't even cross the street to go to an older house?
Yeah, who would have thunk it? Did you have to qualify to be able to give out candy for trick-or-treating? Back when I lived in the other neighborhood, I would decorate. I would buy lots of candy. I would have long stem roses for every mom who stopped by with her kids, just to thank them for coming out and saying hi, being part of the neighborhood. And I don't do any of that anymore. I don't spend a dime on anything with Halloween.
What can you do, do you think, and what can others in your position do to up their Halloween game? Is there a way, you think, that we can get people to cross the street?
Well, I don't think that can be changed. The bottom line here has been for these kids is to get as much as they can with less efforts. Parents will have their kids get in the car and they will drive them over to these neighborhoods.
Sharon, what will you be doing on Halloween in light of everything you've told us?
I will probably be spending time with some friends of mine at a local theme park, enjoying their Halloween celebrations, which include everybody. Of course, everybody who can afford a ticket to the theme park.
And once again, the wealth gap in action. Sharon Hanek, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
We want to keep this conversation going next week. Let us know how you're spending your cash on Halloween. We want to hear about your stories, your traditions. Just visit marketplace.org or you can chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page. Remember to search for Marketplace Business News or call us at 1-800-648-5114. We look to economic indicators, GDP, unemployment, consumer spending, to tell us how the economy is doing. But ultimately, the economy is personal. It feels different to everyone, no matter what the numbers say. That's why we've been collecting stories for a while now from people all over the country. We call it My Economy. Today we hear from a mother who's working to make a better life for her and her family.
My name is Lydia Flores. I work at El Super. El Super is a supermarket. I live in Lancaster, California, and I work in Alameda, California. It's 56 miles to go and 56 miles to go home. Just to try to save money on gas. What I do, I'll catch the train, and that's 2 hours to go and 2 hours to come back home. I've tried to look for a job in Lancaster, but Lancaster is not a big city. It's really small. And then, you know, the stores there, they are not trying to offer you full-time jobs. You know, because I even got on the computer to try to look for a job in Lancaster or Palmdale, anywhere close to home so I can be with my, especially with my son who's autistic and has seizure disorder. I haven't had any luck yet. This year I only made $24,000 in a year. Right now, I have the two boys that I have to support right now because the oldest one, you know, he's out of the house already. But it's still not easy for me because I'm still not making enough because I have to pay mortgage, you know, and all the extra bills that I have to pay, the light, the gas, the water, you know, the trash, the cable bill. And you can't even imagine how I make it because I've had to get... Even the cable, the water, the light has been cut off before because of, you know, not being able to pay. I have to say I'm sorry to my children when my light is cut off. I have to tell them I'm sorry. I didn't have enough to pay for it. I had to pay something else instead of paying the light. Right now, I don't even have much of jewelry because I have to pawn it. I have to pay one bill. Like right now, I already got the disconnection notice for the gas bill. But sometimes I have to overdraw my account. And that's $34 every time I overdraw it, you know. And then that $34 goes to the bank instead of going towards my bill or towards my gas to get to work. That's just how we have to live because we don't make enough. It's not enough. $13 an hour is not enough. I would like to make $17 an hour. That would really help. We need better wages. The cost of living is going up. If they were to pay us what we deserve, what we need, and everything would probably be even better for us, even better for our customers. It's not fair for us to go without water, without light. Do they even know what we go through, you know, as human beings or as workers? That's my story that I have to go through, making $13, $14 an hour.
To To hear more stories from our My Economy series, hop on over to marketplace.org and search for My Economy. You might have noticed that here at Marketplace, we are hot for numbers, stats, forecasts, stocks. We dig them all. Every day, Marketplace's By the Numbers blog tracks them and posts the biggies at marketplace.org. Here are producers Tony Wagner and Raghu Manavalan with some of this week's news by the numbers. Tony?
Thanks, David. Our first number is
$80.
That was the price for a Donald Trump branded dress shirt.
Trump's name is on all sorts of things.
Like casinos.
Ties.
Hotels.
Steaks.
Water bottles.
And his brand as a successful businessman is a cornerstone of his new career in politics.
But his campaign has been embroiled in scandal after scandal since the beginning, and analysts say that's hurt the once lucrative Trump brand.
Of course, his brand with a certain group of consumers, his base of supporters, is as strong as ever.
20%.
According to a new study from the National Bureau of Economic Research, that's the pay cut workers are willing to take for a regular 9-to-5 schedule.
Researchers asked 7,000 applicants for real call center jobs about the compromises they're willing to take.
For people who took part in the study, working from home is worth an 8% pay cut, and workers wouldn't take any pay cut for a more flexible schedule.
4 yuan.
That's the price of a croissant at the Shanghai IKEA. At about 60 cents, it's the cheapest thing in the menu.
Chinese seniors have been buying it so they don't get kicked out of the furniture store, which has been a favorite hangout for years.
They'll stay for hours. There's even a blind dating group.
It's so funny because I thought in America, IKEA is where love goes to die.
There's something known as the Proust questionnaire. It's a semi-standard Q&A popularized by Marcel Proust about life, values, personality, and probably cookie-related recollections. Look it up, kids. We do our own version here with work and money. It's called the Marketplace Quiz. Here's producer Haley Hirschman with this week's guest.
Hey, this is Mark Duplass. I'm a filmmaker, and I have a new movie out called Blue Jay, starring me and Sarah Paulson. Check it out.
Fill in the blank. Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you...
shoes.
What kind of shoes?
Comfortable shoes.
You own a lot of comfortable shoes?
No.
So you should take some of your own advice, maybe?
Yes.
All right. Fair enough. What is the hardest part about your job that no one knows?
You can never finish a piece of work.
What do you mean by that?
There is always something you could do to improve something, and you have to make an arbitrary decision about when it is done, and it is an excruciating process. I made a small movie called Creep that took a year and a half of reshoots to get right.
Wow. And do you feel happy with it now?
I love it very, very much, but it almost killed me.
Did you learn any lessons from making that movie?
Surround yourself with people you love, that you think are smart, but most importantly, that are fun, kind, and generous.
When did you realize that being a filmmaker could be an actual career?
When I was 25 years old, I improvised a short film with my brother in our kitchen in Austin, Texas. It cost us $3 to make, and it was our first movie that went to Sundance. And I sold it for $500, and I realized if I keep my costs low, I can do this and not starve, and I follow that same model today.
What is your most prized possession?
I'm closing my eyes, and I'm not think about this and see what the first thing that comes into my brain is. And it was my children.
I don't know
if that's appropriate or not. I don't possess them. I just heard them. but they are in my home and I created them. So it is the most dear thing to me on the planet for sure.
What is something everyone should own no matter the cost?
A good blender. It is a way to chop up all of the foods that you don't want to eat but are good for your body, along with other foods that are tasty, so that the tastes of the non-delicious foods can be hidden. And this is how you get healthy.
what advice do you wish someone had given you before you started your career?
You don't have to destroy yourself to climb the mountain. You're going to land someplace and you can find a way to be happy there. So you can rest easy and everything will be okay.
When did you realize that?
About 5 minutes ago.
Mark's latest film, Blue Jay, is in select theaters and on digital on-demand platforms right now. This week, Sony entered the world of virtual reality with its PlayStation VR headset. The much-anticipated device is expected to make, well, boku bucks for Sony. The interesting thing is, it runs with the PlayStation 4, and the company's already sold over 40 million of its consoles. However, people who want to play with the PlayStation VR will have to fork over an additional $400 or so for the headset. Ben Johnson's the host of Marketplace Tech. He's here to talk to us about Sony's entry into the world of digital immersion. Hiya, Ben.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. So you've taken some virtual reality out for a test drive, it sounds like.
Oh, man. If there's a pair of goggles out there, I'm putting them on. I've tried them all.
Okay, but this week we saw a new entry, and that would be the PlayStation.
Yes, PlayStation VR. This has been rumored for a long time. It launched this week to much fanfare. This is, in some ways, a really interesting effort by PlayStation because it tries to clear, in one fell swoop, three hurdles to virtual reality. The first is computing power. The second is engaged users who actually want to use this stuff. And the third is content, right? And PlayStation is trying to kind of do all three in one big leap with this thing that connects to PlayStation 4 gaming consoles.
Well, you seem to also have left off price, which is a factor here.
Oh, yes. Always price. Yeah, and it sort of falls in the middle, right? PlayStation VR is going to run you $399. If you look to the right, you'll see pricier versions. You got your Oculus. You got your HTC Vive. These are going to be more than twice that expensive. If you look to your left, you're going to see Samsung VR, about $100. You're going to see Google's Daydream headset, around $79. So, you know, right in the middle there, but still actually the price, or actually more than the price of a PlayStation 4 at this moment. So anyone who buys this thing is got to be willing to pay, you know, for an accessory, what they might pay for a gaming console in the first place.
All right. Well, like you, I've tried VR, and in my case, I got a little nauseous while doing it. But I'm your target market here because my son is a rabid gamer. He plays a lot of those really immersive shooter games like Call of Duty, for this technology seems to be scientifically designed. So is it a must-buy gadget?
Oh, man, how much you got in your Christmas wallet?
Not that much,
David. I think it is a very interesting effort from Sony and PlayStation here. PlayStation 4 is the most popular console in the world right now. They sold, I think, last I checked in May, about 40 million PlayStation 4 consoles. So I think this is good, and I've used it on several games. I will say that just like you, David, I got a little bit woozy, so take a listen to this.
Oh. Strafing will save you. It will also make you a little bit dizzy. I'm in this huge... Oh, jeez. You can't really stop and smell the roses, at least not in this demo.
So that's me playing Battlezone, which you may remember is a long-running computer and video game in which you're in a tank and you're trying to shoot other tanks, et cetera, et cetera. The virtual reality version of this is extremely immersive. And when you're strafing, which is, of course, moving left or right with the controller, it does make you a little bit woozy. And after being after having the headset on for about 10 minutes, I have to say, when you take it off, you really feel the impact that it's kind of had on your eyeballs. I don't know, maybe I'm just getting old, but I do think that there's going to be a barrier to entry there.
Well, you're also raising another thing, and that is it's sort of terra incognita. We don't know the long-term effects of having a screen literally millimeters from your eyeballs. We don't know the long-term effects of having something of that weight on your head, and then how this is affecting your synapses and whatnot. It's just unknown.
It is unknown, although I will say PlayStation VR, the headset is very light. It's very ergonomic. It's very easy to put on. It's also easy to set up. And it's relatively easy to control. We don't know the impact of these things yet necessarily. The short-term impact is, some red markings on your face and you kind of bump into a few things after you've used this for like 45 minutes to an hour, as I did the other night. Yeah.
Well, give me a sense of the experience. I mean, even just something old school like Pac-Man, would you be in the middle of the whole maze with ghosts chasing you? And is it something that actually creates an entirely new experience?
That's a really good question. I think it depends a lot on the content. Look, you bring up a great example. Pac-Man is a very two-dimensional game. And in virtual reality, instead of, going left, right, up, and down, you can actually look left, right, up, down, behind you, all around you, theoretically, if we were going to have a VR version of this. I think a lot of the content is really immersive in that way. So it depends a lot on the content. But generally speaking, it's pretty amazing and it's pretty convincing. It'll be interesting to see where it goes.
A lot of attention has been paid to Facebook's Oculus as the game changer when it comes to VR. So what are the stakes for PlayStation here? Is this the make or break device?
I don't know if it's the make or break device for virtual reality more broadly. I do think it's a very important device for PlayStation. They're making a big deal out of its release. They've already built a lot of content for it. So it's obviously a huge investment by them in virtual reality. But we'll have to wait and see.
When do you think VR hits the mainstream? I mean, in a big way. Is it going to be this holiday season or next year?
Well, it's funny. I've talked to several people who have said, this is the first VR Christmas, and it is true. You've got all these different devices that are available now for purchase as a regular consumer, and that wasn't true a year ago. So we'll see on December 26th.
Thanks, Ben. Always a pleasure, man.
Yeah, thank you.
In Spain, there have been two inconclusive general elections in December and June. They've caused a political stalemate that's prevented a new government from being formed for the last 9 months. But despite the political limbo, the country's economy doesn't seem to be suffering too badly, particularly in an industry where Spain specializes, bars and restaurants. From our partners at the BBC, Guy Hedgeco serves up the paella from Madrid.
It's nearly lunchtime, and business is brisk in one of Madrid's many bars, where coffee, beer, and snacks are all being served. Customers say the lively atmosphere reflects the overall mood in a rebounding economy.
I come here every morning to have a Coke or a pastry with hot chocolate. And now that there's more work for people, you can spend a bit more on having something to eat or drink. If there's more work, people spend more, they go out more and consume more.
I've always gone out regularly. I usually have one or two vermouths and sometimes something to eat. But I see more people going out now. Not so long ago, everyone seemed a bit sad, and now things are a bit happier. People are going out to the bars and shops more.
Just round the corner, near the city's bullring, La Conserva is a relatively new bar, co-owned by Jorge Iglesias and his wife.
We opened the bar last March, but why opening the bar? Well, we thought it was a good opportunity with the economic recovery. Spain has always been a country to get together with your friends, with your family. It's much more often to do it here in bars or restaurants than do it at houses, like is more usual in Central or Northern Europe.
Do you think you would have made that same decision to open a new bar 2 or 3 years ago?
I think that the decision would have been tougher 2-3 years ago. I think that the economic situation wasn't that good or promising a few years ago. I'm not saying that it's incredibly good now because we still have an incredibly high unemployment rate, but it's certainly looking better.
The jobless rate is now at 20%, still high, but better than the 27% it soared to during the country's recession. Acting Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy was keen to play up his economic record on the campaign trail ahead of June's general election.
We promise to continue to ensure economic growth, which is the same thing as improving people's welfare and wealth. And we can promise that, because after 6 years of negative growth in Spain and loss of welfare and wealth, in 2014 our economy grew, and in 2015 we became the country in the EU which was growing the most, ahead of Germany, France and Italy.
Spain hasn't had a permanent government in place since December. But despite the political stalemate, the economic recovery has continued. It's quite visible here on Gran Vía, the big street in central Madrid, where much of the city's commercial and retail activity is based. Now, a few years ago, in the depths of Spain's double-dip recession, many shops and offices in central Madrid were empty and boarded up. That's quite a rare sight now, and many new businesses, including places to eat and drink, are springing up.
Asís González is head of Spanish and Portuguese retail analytics for Nielsen. He says Spain's food and drink industry is mounting a comeback.
Well, the last 7 years until 2015 were bad for the bars, and in 7 years, 25,000 bars were closed. But last year, it started again to open bars. It is not a big number of openings, it's only 1%, but the trend has really changed or turned around in the last year.
Spain has an estimated 260,000 bars and restaurants, the most per capita in the world. And Asís González says they can tell us a lot about the country.
Bars and restaurants, they are a good index to know how healthy the economy in a country like Spain is. Bars are in our DNA, so the Spanish people, when they have more money, they like to spend it in bars. So we go out and have a drink, have something to eat, and it is natural, and we do it since we are kids until we are old.
When you're drinking a glass of La Rioja wine or eating a plate of jamón serrano, it's easy to forget about Spain's political crisis. But if it continues, the economy could start to suffer. At the end of October, the deadline will be up for Spain's political parties to reach an agreement and form a new government. If they don't, there'll be yet another general election. Bar owners and their customers alike are hoping it won't come to that.
That's the BBC's Guy Hedgeko reporting from Madrid. And that's our show for this week. Next week, Lizzie's back as we continue our conversation about how you spend your cash on Halloween. Share your stories and traditions with us by visiting marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, you got to search for Marketplace Business News, or call 1-800-648-5114. Remember, your voice might be used on the air, so be nice. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Haley Hirschman and Vanessa Smith. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Ben Tolliday is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark's our vice president. I'm David Lazarus of the LA Times, and until next time, I'll see you in the business section. This is APM.